Hi everyone, my guest today is Vidya Rajan, a TV and theatre writer, a comic, and a performance maker from Melbourne. Originally, I wanted to talk to Vidya about how comedians and artists of colour can represent their authentic selves in a very white entertainment landscape in Australia, and also about the kinds of things Vidya writes and performs. We ended up talking about some of that, but the conversation kept derailing into weird and wonderful tangents, like life as a sitcom, the internet as consciousness, cockroaches and the end of the world, Mahatma Gandhi and cancel culture, and the sustainability of individualism in the age of global warming. The whole thing is like a strange dream in which things turn into other things, you are yourself but also not yourself, you have a lot of fun, and when you wake up, you cannot describe exactly what the dream was about. Vidya called this a stoner conversation, which is true, it kind of does sound like that. But neither of us is a stoner, nor were we stoned during recording. However, I suggest that your listening experience of this episode should be accompanied by a strong intoxicant of your choice, for more fun. The audio levels in this episode fluctuate a lot. You might have to adjust your volume a few times. I'm so sorry about that. I'm still learning about recording and editing audio. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this conversation and go and check out Vidya's upcoming shows at Melbourne International Comedy Festival 2020. I'll share the links on social media and on the website heckinconcerned.com. I would like to acknowledge that this podcast is recorded on Wurundjeri land. This is Amrita, and you're listening to Heckin' Concerned Podcast. Hi Vidya.
Hello.
And welcome to Heckin' Concerned Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to have you here because I've been telling everyone that I want to interview you. And I'm kind of surprised by how approachable you are because you have this air of cool, like you're so cool and I've always and mysterious, like who is she?
Oh, if you know, you can tell me.
And then, you know, we've got together and discovered we have so many things in common.
So
this is exciting. Now I'm like breaking through this enigma that is Vidya Rajan.
Oh God. Yep.
How would you
welcome?
Well, since we're, you know, since in our culture we describe ourselves by our jobs first.
Sure. Yeah.
If you were to say, hey, so I'm Vidya and I'm...
Yeah. I would say I'm a writer and a comic and a performance maker, and I mainly work in theatre and television.
That's cool.
And I know I can say that because I've had to fill out so many artist bios for grants and various, you know, art events. And each time it's like this existential horror of defining who you are.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah, I've got like a couple of sentences now, but, you know, in a year, who knows if it changes or not.
Does your imposter syndrome ever whisper, you're not an artist? You're not really a writer.
You're
come
not really,
on.
Yeah. Maybe not so much now, but it's not been something that's, yeah, it's not something that came easily to just be like, I'm definitely this, even if internally you've always defined yourself that way. But then once you are trying to do it on, I guess, a more public stage, it can be quite difficult. And I think the industry is also designed to make you feel like you shouldn't say that about yourself. But then conversely, you just have to remember that you meet lots of people who are really ridiculous and full of hot air and are very happy to define themselves that way. I think being a woman and also being a person of color, you often like, I have to do a PhD and I have to do like 8,000 jobs and then I can call myself the thing. Whereas a lot of other people, once you're in there for a while, you realize have done like a small thing and they're just like, yeah, I deserve everything.
So
you just got to hold on to that kind of annoyingness, and then you might define yourself that way.
Yeah, that's amazing that you've understood that.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't happen overnight, but yeah.
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 I've also fallen into the trap personally of thinking that I don't have enough life experience to be able to do something, that I need to live a bit more and
totally
have a richer experience.
Yeah.
And the other day I was reading some fantastic words from Kurt Vonnegut, who said that even if you just write about the suburb that you grew up in, and this is paraphrasing, he was talking about
another writer and how that writer wrote entirely about the childhood town he grew up in.
Mm.
Even just then, that's rich enough and that's acceptable enough.
Yeah.
As experience in your life. And that's beautiful because that is something that you love and that moved you. And if you have the ability to write about it or perform it in a way that moves somebody,
somebody that's good else. Enough. Yeah, I think that's really interesting. But I don't know if it's like we've only been like a minute in and I'm like, how deep do we go? But I think it's...
Dive right in,
like into the anthropology of that. No, I feel like... What Kurt says, you know, my old buddy Kurt, this is very, very true, but I don't want to like minimize or diminish the fact that a lot of people, you're kind of almost like gaslit by mainstream culture or arts culture to feel like those experiences aren't valid, you know, like I think whiteness can do that, but also other, lots of other factors can do that. I think for a long time we have felt like the only things worth writing about, even if we are writing about the suburbs, it's like a man in the suburbs or a certain type of woman in the suburbs. It's not people who look like you or me, or it's not people with very particular experiences that have never been represented on the world stage. So I think those statements are very fine and emboldening, but it's also very real to feel like your experience isn't worth representing. Mm. And that's like a barrier you have to work through. Because a lot of the time... for a long time it hasn't been. It's only starting to change. Like if you had gone up to even a major theater company like a few years ago and been like, I want to write about this particular diaspora experience experienced in this place, and it's rich and it's huge, they'd be like, oh, but why? You know, so it wasn't just all in our heads. Like, so I feel like, it's often we can read quotes like that and be like, oh, I was stopping myself, but I'm like, no, it wasn't you. You're not an idiot.
Yeah.
It's the world.
The kind of messages you're getting about
totally.
Also the kinds of stories people actually do want to hear, like I don't want to tell a story about a big fat Indian wedding, or not necessarily talk about a very stereotype idea of an Indian family. My identity and yours is much more nuanced,
very complex.
And I think that opportunities for writers to display that nuance of writers who are people of color from minority cultures in a, say, for example, in Australia, those opportunities are quite less.
Yeah, of course, they're limited and they're kind of opening up now, but come with their own perils as well. Like, so,
Do you think that there are unspoken quotas for example, you write a proposal for a TV show about an Indian family, but if it doesn't meet the stereotype in the minds of the people that are receiving the proposal or grant, if they don't see a sellable point there, like, you know, there's no like intros of sitar music and saris hung in the backgrounds of people's home randomly, or just like anything that is very stereotyped, do you think that they'll pass on that because it's too nuanced and not
It depends on
iconic
the
enough?
It depends on the network. Like, I think a commercial network, there might be some difficulties there. This is why, like, it's so, like, the people making those decisions, that's why they need to be people with more diverse experience, or who are sensitive to those things, and you can't always ensure that, even still. Like, it can seem like it's changing because you always have, like, these announcements of programs and all this kind of thing, but that's in, like, a very small bubble, you know, and that's often just, like a bit of your, like, government-funded screen bodies, like Screen Australia or, like, SBS or whatever, but... who those gatekeepers are is a huge deal. But it's also like, I think the insidiousness of this is that it's also just like the fact that we are talking about a market. So it's capitalism. So like, what can they sell? Like, so sometimes a lot of gatekeepers, they might be aware of these issues. They might be like, oh, this is a bit cliched, or this is, you know, we don't want to perpetuate these stereotypes. But then they'll be like, well, I can't sell a different version to my network, or like people aren't going to tune in. So it's like both. It's also audiences are assumed to have certain tastes, which are sometimes true, like a lot of mainstream Australia does not maybe want to listen to other stuff. So yeah, it's going both ways, I think.
But you're a TV writer, so what are you writing?
What am I writing? Ooh. Well, the thing about being a TV writer is that you write on other people's stuff a lot of the time. So I've written on a couple of comedy series. I'm writing on an audio comedy series at the moment as well, which I just lump in with TV because it's all connected.
Is it going to be a podcast?
It's a podcast. Yeah, sometime next year it should come out. So it's like, I don't know if I can say what the company is yet, but narrative sitcoms are like a big thing in audio now. So it's one of those things. Yeah, it's very interesting taking like TV writing and trying to put it just for the ear.
Is there going to be a laugh track on a narrative sitcom?
I don't think so. Not that I know.
No, because laugh tracks are mainly for visual gags, aren't they?
Laugh tracks, yeah, I guess they're for visual gags. I don't even know if many sitcoms use laugh tracks anymore. It feels like a relic of a 90s thing or just a very American studio thing.
Yeah.
No, I don't know if that's... I think the laugh track, because it's supposed to be for one person at a time, so I think it's just you supply that. It might be a bit weird if there's somebody laughing in your ear suddenly.
Well, you can have your own laugh track going on in your mind, you know?
And I often do. No, but it's...
my life is a sitcom.
Yeah.
I come prepared with my own laugh track.
Yeah. Do you view your life as a sitcom?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
A lot of my initial work with a psychologist many years ago was her trying to convince me that TV and movies aren't real life. As I was seeing my life as a rom-com, as a sitcom, as, you know.
I find that so interesting.
Or even now, like my favorite sitcom of all time is Frasier.
And really?
Yeah.
I didn't think you were going to say Frasier.
Frasier is the best show. It's like a fantastic mix between really intellectual highbrow comedy and slapstick. And
is this why you're doing this podcast? So to get yourself a little bit of Frasier cream? Because we are literally in like a small kind of booth right now.
And You're listening.
Yeah.
No, my sister actually said to me, I have to modulate my voice for the podcast to make it like Roz.
Yeah.
Like deeper, sexier. Right. Really just soothing to the ears.
Yeah.
And I'm trying. So yeah. I don't know if any listeners can pick up, but today my speaking voice is much lower than it usually is. I sound like a 12-year-old otherwise.
But I think that's, I find it really interesting that you said you sort of viewed your life through all these genres and stuff, because I think I don't know if I... No, I think that's a tendency a lot of like arty kids have. Like you impose those structures on reality.
Yeah.
As a way of coping with reality.
Absolutely.
And especially if you're like this, like you said, like me, you grew up like in the Middle East as well, like the South Asian kid in the Middle East, and then you move to another country. So like, I guess your home is art and storytelling, and that's because that can go from continent to continent, you know, wherever you go, and you just consume that media and it's in your bones. And also you're often not very prepared for real life because, you know, culture and stuff.
Yeah.
So when you get out there, you're like, is this a sitcom or is it a this? Yeah, I think that's very funny.
I think anyone that has taken refuge as a child in their imaginations to escape reality is probably prone to this kind of idolization of
I think TV. That's one of the harshest lessons to learn as an adult, that you can't, like, life isn't a narrative.
So I know that things don't happen with,
arcs and
arcs,
and
acts, and also
justice is not served.
Exactly. Coincidences will not happen randomly.
Yeah.
No matter how many times you zoom out and see, you know, visualize yourself, like if you're crying, like I do this often, even now, if I'm crying, I have an out-of-body experience where I go, oh my God, this is such aesthetic tears.
Right.
Like, this would make a beautiful scene right now.
What's my lighting right now?
Right, would I be looking in a mirror and crying? Would I be looking out of a window and crying? Like, how would they frame my face?
How would they do it? Yeah, and what, you know... And what happens right after this that, like, changes everything.
Exactly. So these tears are not significant, really, in the broad scheme of things. They're just the moment right now.
Yeah.
That was a hard lesson to learn.
I think it's a coping mechanism with reality. I don't think it's a healthy thing.
No.
I had a writing lecturer at VCA who, I think, was saying that apparently a lot of writers have that kind of...
Yeah.
Constant observation, I suppose, of yourself as material as well. And it just reminded me that my dreams have always been, so when you dream at night, do you dream in the third person or through yourself?
Through myself,
maybe. Since I was a little kid, I've always seen myself in my dreams which sounds psychotic now that I say it, but I thought this was normal.
It sounds really cool. Like, how do you see yourself? Do you see yourself authentically as your body and your mind is, or do you see yourself as a white kid, or do you see yourself as taller or different looking?
It used to be just me, but then over the last maybe like 5-6 years, I've been other people, but I've known that that was me.
Yeah, yeah. That happens to me so often. Yeah. So even though I'm looking, so it's a first person point of view in my dreams, but I'm sometimes a man, sometimes a woman, sometimes somebody else entirely.
Yeah.
It changes in the middle of the dream.
Yeah. It's kind of cool.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you ever have this where you wake up and the dream was so awesome that you can't wait to go back to bed the next night and hope to have it again?
Ah, yeah. Mm. No, I don't think I trust my brain to have the same one again, but I do. Sometimes I'm just like, I wish I just kept sleeping.
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes my dreams are so cool and so adventurous. Like, I build gorgeous worlds in my dream.
Yeah. And then you wake up and you're like, I can't remember how to do that. Yeah. I feel like, yeah, I always get worried about, like, my mental health when my dreams are very close to life. Like, when they're just spelling out what your problem is. It's like, oh, no.
Yeah.
My subconscious couldn't even go to the effort to, like, insert a symbol or, like, create a metaphor. It's just like, this is what you're worried about.
Yeah, well, that's like, when the worry is so big.
Yeah,
that
it just tells you.
Yeah. Yeah. Where were we?
I don't know.
We've gone down a beautiful rabbit hole.
It was about... writing.
Yeah. I think, should we attempt to come back or should we go? No, let's attempt to come back because you were making a good point.
It's your shows.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we were talking about writing, very stereotype.
Mm.
Okay, well, on this topic, I'll mention something else that I really loved about 2019 for me, which was discovering Hasan Minhaj.
Oh, right. The Patriot Act.
Patriot Act guy. So before I'd never heard of him, and then I watched Patriot Act and I don't know how familiar you are with Hindi and Hindi movies, but
speak and I understand.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
So this one episode, he was talking about Modi and Trump, and he goes, there's a picture of them shaking hands, and in the middle of his, you know, he's speaking English, and suddenly he bursts into Hindi song and goes, "Tum paas aaye."
Yeah.
And I was like, "Whoa!"
Yes,
yep. I was really amazed that on a big mainstream network.
Yeah.
So political commentary has been the purview of white comedians.
Of course. Yeah.
Traditionally. So he's already an Indian guy in that space.
Mm.
He is doing all of his, you know, things in English, but then he just out of nowhere drops this reference in another language to another culture that is also a part of him.
Yeah.
People laugh, some people don't get it, but he doesn't care.
No.
And he just keeps doing that. For example, I listened to him on a podcast called Armchair Expert.
Yeah.
And he just dropped words in Hindi. He used words like desi.
Yeah.
And so then Dax Shepard, who's the host of the podcast, goes, "What's desi?" And, he didn't even care. And I just love the fact that Hasan Minhaj could be so authentic to all aspects of himself.
Yeah.
That he's like, you know, a sneaker freak. He loves basketball, but he also likes Indian culture, but he also likes political commentary and, you know, like all of this.
Mm.
So have you had that thing in your work where you will embrace all aspects of yourself as a person, not just an Indian, not just an Australian?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's like a constant like state of getting there and becoming. But I think like a lot of artists from any kind of minority will, especially talking perhaps about race and culture, will go through these phases if you're in a white country or a Western country, where the first sort of phase is that you need to not write about it at all or not show it at all. And then the second is you find ways. And this is kind of what annoyed me. I did the show a few years ago that was sort of took aim at some of this, but also that you offer it up. You offer up your culture as a thing to laugh at, but you're still doing it from this very internalized, like, self-loathing. And then I think when you truly move past that, you do it on your own terms and you're like, screw the burden of translation. Like, they can come to the table. But there's still a fine line because you don't want to be so extreme that this is just basic performance. Like, you can't alienate your audience completely. So you're aware that, and that line isn't like, and sometimes it's, and you would know this, it's very irritating to even do that. The cognitive load of having to balance all these things and get to that place. And whereas a lot of other performers can just like get up there, like, you know, and just do whatever. And because they have the lightness of never having to translate or never having to take into account how to make people comfortable on so many levels at once before they're given permission to do what they want.
Yeah, I feel that.
And I've gone through all that. And I think now I'm at a phase in my work where either it's something I can do a lot quicker so the burden doesn't feel that intense, or I also just don't care. Or I also try to seek out communities of color so that I can feel safe to do some other stuff that I couldn't do elsewhere. But I think it's a critical mass thing as well. Like, I think America's so far ahead. It's like in terms of migration population as well, there's just so many people from the subcontinent, but also their media industry has platformed those people a lot more. And so they, Hassan, can do that. Not worry about it.
Or Lily Singh can have a show in Canada, which has got huge diasporas from all kinds of countries. And she can get a following of all races because there's that critical mass.
There's a critical mass and there's that reach. Whereas here, I don't think that's there. I mean, like, I can see beginnings of it, but it just, it always feels like... I guess, I don't know, I guess maybe we're in the first... we're at the beginning of it. So we can't, maybe in a few years, it'll be like, oh, fine.
I think so. We're getting there. For example, in a lot of American comedy, you just have to have like, you just have to say, oh, I was raised Catholic, and everyone will start laughing. Or you just have to say like, you just have to say Jewish guilt and everyone will know what you're talking about. And so those cultures are so well known and they've already got a lot of exposure through the arts. And now as well, Indian and other cultures are getting exposure. So for us, we're quite new in that way. I think in Australia, apart from the mainstream white Australian culture, there's only a few other really well-known tropes or you know, cultural symbols of other cultures that easily get, like, you would probably have like, you know, Greek and Italian families or whatever.
They've sort of reached that kind of critical mass where, I think you know you're okay when you can do like a stereotype, because, like, you know, we all want to make fun of like our aunties or whatever. When you can do that and you can feel comfortable doing that, and that like a white audience isn't going to take that as fuel to confirm their their biases, or take it as fuel to reduce you. But can take it in the spirit of this. There's like complex things here, and it's funny, and then you get to do it, and we're not going to try and get in on it.
So, I think the onus is on the person that's presenting it to present the universal aspects of that, and not just get laughs off the stereotypes, or, you know, quick laughs out of, you know, hey, look, I'm an Indian and Australian, but present stories in which they highlight universal themes.
And I'm I think a little confusion is fine if they don't get it at first.
So the internet is a theme that occurs quite frequently in your work. You told me,
because we grew up on it, right?
How it does it come across in your work? What about it interesting? How do you write about it or perform about
I think that's it's just, it's so ubiquitous. It's, I think it's like, it's an aesthetic as well. Like, my humor is very informed by being extremely online. How does it come across? I don't know. I think it's in like speed, it's in variety. Like, you know, it's kind of like in a sort of freedom as well, because you can be all these very shifting things online. And it's also like a hellscape. Like, I feel like if you're not kind of talking about the internet in your work right now, you're kind of ignoring reality. Like, it's completely shaped our world, if you, especially if you make political work or whatever. It's like, it's not a, as you would know as well, it's not like this weird different space. It's just like a continent that we all belong to.
In that way, it's really quite unifying, because we might have different Instagram feeds and different Facebook feeds, and the ads that are served to us might be different, but the experience of being on the internet is so similar across the world. I mean, there are variations, like, for example, if you're a woman, you have a slightly different experience than a man, or, you know, whatever.
Totally. There's so many different sections, and some of them truly horrific. A lot of them. But I think even, but what it's done to the rhythms of our not just our humor, but like our attention or the way we speak or the self, like what, you know, like what it's done to how we conceptualize the self, I think is quite, it sounds so wanky, but I think it's like, it's what you're kind of talking about as well, like what you can express and how you express it and how performative you are with expressing it. And so, did you do like English at uni or?
My major was English literary studies, but I don't remember anything.
Well, I think there's this, because I'm being a lit nerd, but like I feel like there is, you know, like the novel is like, or like most art, like if you study through most time periods, like it's, you can view it through the lens of like what it says about how we conceive the self in different time periods. Like, you know, like impressionism as an art movement has a whole thing with it, or like modernism, like the self was viewed as this thing that was subject to different forces, and then postmodernism, like there is no self, blah, blah, blah. And I think like the internet is like such a great place to study about like how we want to define consciousness almost.
Yeah.
Like, I've been thinking a lot lately about like becoming a bot, like what it would mean to be a bot and then achieve that level of consciousness, like of, like automation as well, and like that impulse. And I don't know, this is just like I'm giving you very scattered thoughts from like my art diary, but
that's really nice. I'm privileged to hear some of your scattered thoughts.
There you go. I think it's really fascinating. I think like it's such a huge force in our lives and and how we experience reality. So
well, we are kind of like bots. I mean we've got automated actions, so I, for example, frequently just reach down into my pocket and I might not pick up my phone. I might remember that I'm trying not to look at it so much, but I'll just finger it.
Yeah.
It's there.
It's there.
It's an unconscious action, or you just don't even realize how many times a day you take out your phone, flip through all of the screens, just check it, you know, Messenger, Facebook, the trifecta, Instagram, just to see. Maybe WhatsApp. If nothing is there anywhere else, you just check, like, maybe on WhatsApp somebody said something to me. Yeah. Nobody ever has.
Yeah.
So, in a way, we're kind of like bots. We're programmed to, like, you know, now anything that is worth anything has to be marked by a selfie or
a picture. Yeah, yeah.
So the way we're looking at, or even our ideas of self are so influenced by the internet. So if we're looking really good on a particular day, did we really look good if we didn't post it on the internet?
Yeah.
Like, did we really look good if nobody took a picture of us anywhere?
Yeah.
We feel like the effort was wasted, whereas...
Yeah, it's like if a tree falls in the forest and the tree doesn't scream about how like cute it was, did
was it even?
Did we even go out? Yeah. Like, who are, you know, why didn't you call me? Anyway,
your brain is a weird place, Vidyarajan.
Yeah, it's quite weird.
One time I read this post from you on Facebook. No, don't apologize. Please don't apologize. It's beautiful. You wrote a status update about how you pitched a story to your dad about these cam girls that are half cockroach, half human.
Yeah.
And I was like, what the fuck is this? Like, how does her brain work?
Oh, that's so funny you bring that up, because, like, clearly, like, I haven't moved. I think it was, like, about half a year ago. So that's fine. I haven't had to progress that much. But I was thinking, I guess, like, that whole cockroach thing. That's like, I think will probably be a show at some point.
Oh, wow.
But with that, I don't know if I should give away the ending, but with that, I guess I'm also talking, like I was thinking about like, I guess that post-humanism and like turning into different things and then turning into bots and like what it means to live in a body at like what feels like the end of the world. Like, you know, like late capitalism, blah, blah, the planet's dying, and like how do we transcend this form that we're in? Would we... you know, mate with cockroaches, would we become pure data? Like, I just like...
Oh, that's compelling.
Yeah, yeah. Like, so it's just like how to transform our literal, like, physical beings. I don't know, I've been finding that really fascinating. It's probably just a symptom of living in such an apocalyptic time that, like, we're trying to escape the constraints of the sad human body. Like,
yeah, it is actually an apocalyptic time. I mean, digressing a little bit, I said to my friend the other day, she said, it feels like an apocalypse. And I'm like, but my love, it is an apocalypse. You know, let us call a spade a spade.
Yeah.
This is the beginning of the end.
Yeah.
And we're lucky that we're not going to see the worst of it.
Yeah, right.
You know, we're going to be dead in the next 50, 60 years, all of us that are our age.
Yeah.
And it's kind of selfish as well to think that, thank God, we're not going to see the worst of it.
True. That's, yeah, it's really, I don't know. Like, I'm just like the other day, like, because some friends were like, I think about, you know, people having kids and stuff and whether that's an ethical thing to be doing now. And I'm like, I don't know, how do we begin to answer that? I was like, maybe in 5 years we'll know. But then I was like, but isn't that what we said 5 years ago?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. And then I'm also like, it's very interesting because a lot of like, obviously like Indigenous cultures are like, we experienced apocalypse all the time. Like we've experienced this, like it's in a way treating climate change disaster as this apocalypse is also a very...
White centric
can be, yeah.
Capitalist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're like, we've already done that. Like, we had our apocalypse and we've been having it for like 200 years or more. But then, yeah. And then obviously with our histories, like, you know, like being colonized by the British and stuff, I don't think, like, we were talking about this a little bit earlier as well, like how South Asian migration has become like a history of like forgetting as well. Like it's like, yes, we experienced that bad stuff, but we have to move to these countries and just make like a stable life for our families. Like that's become their story more.
I think maybe South Asian families have experienced all of these upheavals that migration has brought on them.
Yeah.
That maybe that's why, as we were talking about before, they don't really want to engage in the idea of global warming, climate change, because they're tired and they thought, they thought we already did this massive thing. We just moved across oceans, continents, hemispheres.
Do you find a reluctance to talk about like even like British colonization in like with your family or it's just like this fact that gets thrown off? Like nobody sits with the trauma of it or...
Yeah, I definitely think that there's a lot of, reluctance to sit and think about the trauma of what happened. I don't think people generally talk about that in families.
Mm.
They might, you know, there might be moments where somebody might swear bloody colonizers, or somebody might say, oh, you know, these were the atrocities that happened. But we don't really talk about how they affect us personally. My sister and I were having a discussion the other day about how we feel now that we've discovered that Gandhi was heckin' problematic.
That's true.
And
I find Gandhi so fascinating. Like, just this, like, cultural figure who was, like, so... We were supposed to, like, love immensely.
The father of the nation. Father of the nation,
yeah.
Mahatma. So, you know, just the other day... we were watching something. We're watching Kaun Banega Crorepati, which is the Indian version of Who Wants to...
Is Amitabh Bachchan still hosting
it? He is. God, yeah. So for those uninitiated, it is the Hindi version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And it's actually much better than the English version. It's a much bigger cultural phenomenon in India.
Mm.
So it was like Gandhi Jayanti, which is Gandhiji's birthday special. By the way, Gandhiji also means just Gandhi. My God, I have to do so much translating today.
It's fine. They can look it up.
Yeah, so my mum was sitting there and she sometimes snorts in this kind of disapproving way. Anytime anybody brings up like Ram from Ramayana or like so problematic men. So my sister and I were talking about how does it make us feel that this person that we were, you know, in school and culturally conditioned to adore was kind of creepy in many ways.
Yeah, super creepy.
And so it was this, you know, in the current political climate, in right now we're all dealing with the aftermath of a bunch of accusations in many different countries as part of the Me Too movement, and we've realized that our idols have feet of clay. So to realize that somebody like Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi...
But like everyone's cancelled, like throughout history.
Yeah.
Like just everyone's cancelled. Yeah. There's very few people who wouldn't be cancelled.
But the thing is, had he... Like he has actually directly impacted you and me.
Oh, true. Yeah.
Oh, that is...
Literally our lives.
Literally our lives. Yeah. Like would our parents have been able to come to Australia if our grandparents hadn't been... in a world in which Gandhi fought for
independence. Yeah.
We actually owe some far off debt.
Yeah.
To the movement that he was a part of.
Of course, yeah. And I mean, billions of people do, but
Yeah.
I don't know what the point is. I just all I could think about was, but now, like, with the rise of Hindu nationalism in India, like, Gandhi is viewed as this bad figure for them.
Yeah.
Because he was quite into secular thought, and so
I don't even know what's happening in India.
It's a lot.
It's crap.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
I am very concerned about the rise of right-wing
nationalists
across the world.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, everyone from ScoMo to Modi to Trump.
Yeah.
In Brazil, there's Bolsonaro.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of right-wing people coming up across the world. Mm. I think even the UK government is a right-wing government currently.
I know, yeah.
Who's the new prime minister?
In the UK?
Yeah.
Boris Johnson's the current prime minister. Yeah. And in the same mold as the Trumps and ScoMos. Yeah, I think it's very funny. I was just like, because I was just remembering this comedy bit I do about Gandhi, this kind of like weird sketch. And I was just like thinking about that. And I'm like, it just really brought home. I'm like, oh, the comedy isn't going to fight anything in the world. Like, you're just mentioning all those horrifying leaders. And I'm like, yep. Just the distance between that. Sometimes I think, like, as an artist, you can be like, what am I doing with my life? Why am I doing this bit where I talk to, like, a spectral Gandhi figure who tells me to stop obsessing about white dick if I want to decolonize myself? And I was like, who is this helping? But, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, it is helping people.
Yeah, it's like, making people
–
yeah.
It is. Okay, like – can you stop obsessing about white dick? I don't know. Like, I was raised on American TV.
Yeah.
And now I grew up, like, my teens and 20s and all my life after my teens has been in Australia.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, the dominant hotness around us is white hotness.
Oh, no.
Plus...
Nah.
No, not for you.
No, I think you can stop feeling that way to white people. It is possible.
Okay.
All you need to do is, like, talk to Gandhi. It's like, are you there, Gandhi? It's me, I'm Ruth. I think it's possible. That's really interesting. I mean, going back to the internet as well, I feel like, you know, like Tumblr and stuff like happened in like my early 20s. And then were you ever on Tumblr or just on like on those kind of platforms?
I know I wasn't on Tumblr, but I know that, you know, pictures are shared and people reblog it.
Yeah. I just feel like it's quite, you know, people see like the internet's this really angry place and like a lot of like, white men especially are very threatened on it, like and now we have like, you know, Scott Morrison whatever talking about like inner city progressives, and it gets this kind of rap as like this incredibly angry place. But I also think it's like it's such a historical emancipatory space. Like I remember being on like those platforms quite young, like they had such a huge part to play in like me undoing even internalized, like speaking of like what you find from something as basic as what you find attractive, just by seeing images of like women of color or like other people of color, being surrounded by communities of color that couldn't find themselves like in your high schools or, you know, but then you found them on the internet and then you could all together like read activist thought or read about like experiences that were like yours or just like literally look at people who looked like you and see them viewed as whole, not even just attractive, but just like whole. And so I feel like for like people nowadays, it's very easy to be like, oh, it's this like cesspit of yelling and cancellation. But it had such a huge shift to do in a lot of people like understanding their identities in a much, much safer way and like in a way that didn't kowtow to white supremacy.
Yeah.
So
I think the internet is really beautiful for that. In my previous episode, I was talking to Bree Turner, who also studies consciousness raising and identity creation on the internet for women and non-binary people.
Yeah.
And you can't be aware of what you are until you see it represented. And for all the ills and evils of, you know, the internet, like Facebook has been a lot in the news recently as I think Sacha Baron Cohen called it a propaganda machine and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But for all of that, like, we really wouldn't be the feminists or the people of color we are today.
Yeah.
Had it not been for
the ability to connect to those people who could bring that information to us, because it wasn't, I remember, like, because I came here late in high school, and I just remember, like, there was, like, for instance, there was 30 pages on, like, one event, like, in World War One, like, but then there was, like, a paragraph or half a page on, like, the Pinjarra Massacre in WA, and then maybe, like, a page on the Stolen Generations in our history book, but then, like, you know,
yeah,
about 50 pages on what uniforms, yeah, like, people wore. So it's just, like, that's a very blatant example, but it's just representative of, like, these institutions that seem transparent and innocent, especially if you're growing up.
Yeah.
As the font of knowledge.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, the internet's been great for knowledge disruption. Mm. But now we're seeing it turn into, like, you know, incel central, and, like, it's also equally helped other minorities, like fascists. So, I don't know. Anyway, what were we talking about?
I wanted to talk about late capitalism.
Cool. I mean, I guess we kind of have been, but yeah.
Is that what you conceptualize as late capitalism?
Yeah, I mean, like, it's a very fashionable term, isn't it? And I'm no, like, I can't pretend to be a scholar, like an economist. But yeah, I think we're, like, living at this time when, like, the excesses of capitalism that was always horrific, are just, we're more aware of them, and we can see them much more on a global scale, and it seems to be getting to an untenable point purely because it's pushed the environment to such a point as well. It feels like a moment where you need to decide how to take action in the world, and, like, it's not enough to just be like, oh, I vote a certain way, or I read the think pieces and I know what to think, and yeah, like, what does activism mean in the face of all this? I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out, like, yeah, what is useful and what is ethical.
For me, and you raise such a fantastic point, what does activism mean? And that comes back to what is our personal, the concept of self.
Mm-hmm.
The concept of self as, so late capitalism, the way I have understood it through my research over the last 2 days, after you sent me an email saying late capitalism, I'm like, what the hell is this? It's coming up everywhere.
Yeah.
I read a bunch of articles, watched a bunch of YouTube videos on it. So I feel a little prepared now.
Oh, great. You probably know more than me. Go on.
No, but this idea that all of us are a brand.
Oh, totally.
A personal brand on Facebook and on Instagram, whether you're posting pictures of yourself or whether you're posting a status update about your political rants or your books that you read, whatever. We're all trying to create a personal brand. But in order to be a part of any kind of revolution for the climate and the environment, we have to...
You can't be a brand.
You can't be a brand. You can't sustain the consumption required to be a brand. You kind of have to, like, be plain and merge into the mass.
That's really interesting because on a purely material level, being a brand does take up resources.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, not even just talking psychologically, but literally you'd consume things to create that image.
Absolutely.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
With Margot Tanhodko last season,
yeah,
we talked about this idea, like, capitalism. We were talking about how shopping, capitalism, materialism is such an important part of who we are now, because in order to be somebody, we have to get the look. We have to get the camera phone, even.
Yeah.
Or we have to have our senses bombarded by ads in order to use the free service that allows us to promote our brand.
Yeah.
If you're not promoting yourself, who are you really? Kind of.
Yeah.
I think
it's really interesting. Again, this is going to sound so esoteric, but this whole conversation's really veered off into abstraction, so it's fine, I think.
There's no theme.
Yeah,
to
I was
this.
Just like, oh, no. Yeah, I was going to talk about writing, but let's just talk about all the problems of the world and sound really foolish while doing so. I find really interesting, like, how you can call it capitalism, but I think it's also a very human tendency, like, this reduction of the self to something we can transfer to other people, like a brand. And I think, like, one of the things that's one of the way our souls are, soul is, like, I mean, quote marks, soul, like, whatever it stands for, the self is, like, it's calcified by living in this sort of environment. Like, you, the last thing, or maybe the first thing we package is ourselves. And then I think we lose, I don't know, the ability to sustain truly complex and rich relationships with people and communities. I think that's, like, a huge crisis facing us, like, the lack of wanting to disappear into a mass.
Yeah.
It is, like, individualism is a very capitalistic thing, and, like, this very the self with a lot of borders and like property rights and like
The things that if you're looking for example, in a romantic relationship, you're looking for a partner.
Yeah.
You need to find somebody that supports your brand and boosts your personal, you know, like they can fit in your life.
Yeah.
And it's less about going with tradition and going with what everyone else is doing and more about finding like a right fit.
A right fit. Yeah. And like how we conceptualize ourselves as like deserving certain things.
Yeah.
I think it's very interesting because I was, I guess, raised in a Hindu framework. I'm not particularly religious, but I think a lot of that philosophy has probably seeped into my brain in a very deep way. But I think I've always been obsessed, and this kind of goes back to our bot conversation slightly about like what does it mean to transcend the self, and like what is egolessness, and like, in our cultures have got a lot of issues and very traumatic in a lot of ways. But I think one of the things that they kind of get right or have, you know, is this kind of understanding the self as a community of relationships rather than a thing that exists on its own. You're only like your relation to other people and to the world, and you're constantly becoming. You're not like this fixed thing. And it's when we start to view ourselves the ego of the fixed thing that you start to enact violence on other people, because you'll do anything to maintain that fixture. So I think that's again very Hindu kind of thought pattern as well, like to try and disseminate that.
Mm.
But then obviously the country is a terrible mess, so it doesn't mean anybody there has absorbed the philosophy either. No. But I think I don't know if that's something you've got in your background as well.
I wasn't raised in a very religious way. I mean, my family, my sister and I are now finally come around to calling ourselves atheists, because it just sounds so harsh and final when you say atheist. But we're calling ourselves vegans, we might as well call ourselves atheists. So
I don't think it's about God, it's more like a philosophy of just a way of like looking at life or the self as the aim of life, I guess, in a lot of philosophy, to put it in Hindu philosophy, is to disappear the self, become one with the force.
Yeah.
But I
get what you're saying, because my own individual concept of self has evolved from when you're a kid and you're a part of a family and your consciousness is largely what your parents are doing, saying around you. Your worries are also largely your parents' worries that you take on.
Mm.
And then growing up, going to therapy, I had to first find my individual identity as myself without my family. And then now it's kind of evolved to it's actually a relief to not be unique. It is a relief to not be special in any way.
That's really interesting,
because not only does it mean that you're not special, it's not only that this is a negative thing, but also that it means that your troubles are not unique. People around you suffer as you do.
I know, because it's actually quite egotistic to think that nobody has it as bad as you.
Yeah.
Right?
If nobody could have all of your qualities and all of your cool stuff, then
nobody could have your problems either. Yeah.
And that sucks. So therefore, if people around you are, people are more similar than you think, and you're less unique, that's actually a very comforting thing for me now.
Yeah. I think it's also a struggle, because vaguely trying to bring this conversation back to the arts. I think that's what we were talking about. I don't know.
Originally I wanted to talk about, people of color, POC and arts.
Well, I think I can find a link between these two things somehow. Because you're talking about you're not wanting to hold yourself out as unique in that way. But I think if you're a POC in the arts industry now as well, but or anyone, because it is an industry, you're very much encouraged to package yourself as this new exciting voice who's the answer to everything.
Yeah.
And this POC is the POC. And also whiteness will often be we got one. We got one funny brown person. We got one weird Asian. And then that's, we don't need any more. And it creates this horrible, I think this very capitalist kind of way of viewing art, but also packaging yourself and your brand as an artist and all this kind of thing that is not actually used, doesn't create solidarity, I don't think creates, I don't know what great art is, but I don't think creates good art communities.
Yeah.
And so I think, like, as people of color, like, for me, I feel I'm, it could be very easy to become like that. And, but I think I'm also trying to, like, I'm like, who am, it, to me, it's important to be a okay person as well as a good artist. And sometimes it can feel like a trade-off.
Yeah. So you don't want to capitalize on your difference in order to get the gigs. No. You kind of have to, but you want to just be overall an artist who is true to all herself.
Yeah.
All the, so even if you don't get the job because you're a person of color, but you get it because you're a talented writer. Sorry, I'm not saying that that's how it should be. I'm saying even if you did that, say there were like five black people in that group. So that it was not a quota or a diversity thing, but you would still bring all of yourself to it.
Yeah, no, and I do, but I think it's just like, being aware of not being consumed that way. Like, I think like quotas are great. Like, you need to do something to fix it, and the work is going to be richer and better. Like, you can just tell, like, sometimes, like, when I've been in a room with like a lot of people of color, or just like even having a couple in the space, the dialogue is richer, the ideas are more complex, because in many ways, like, actually this very small Anglo art creation is just such a small part of the world's history and the world's culture. And if we want to be talking about modernity and like this very global world we live in, then all these other identities are, they are the world. And like, it's only this kind of like historical, almost like gaslighting, that makes you think that you're not. So those rooms are always more interesting.
I mean, they would be. For example, even the simple act of the fact that most people in those rooms are probably bilingual or multilingual. People are already thinking in their minds thoughts across different languages. So obviously connections, ideas are going to be complex.
Like, the creativity is different.
So the future of the Australian entertainment TV landscape, right? So do you...
I don't know what it is.
Like, we've got a Benjamin Law, for example.
Sure.
Do you think that there's room for, like, a lot more Asians, a lot more Indians, a lot more...
I mean, I hope so. I mean, we just talked about, like, how the industry doesn't want, like, or, like, wants you to differentiate yourself. Like, you know, you've got to be, like, deeply different Asians, whereas, like, two white women with brown hair can both be quirky and both be lauded. And, like, I'm like, but they're as different as, you know, it doesn't like seeing you as, like,
it's quite reductive, isn't it? Like, you're Asian, you're Asian.
I think it does the industry have space. I feel like it'll have space because we are, if we continue to push, that it needs that. And I think also, like, if we support each other, like, I think the worst thing that could happen now would be, like, for... And it does happen, but for, like, for artists of color or across class and race to, like, kind of abandon each other in the quest for something. I guess I'm very interested in, like, ethical ways of working and stuff, so that's kind of on my mind a lot lately. But yeah, is there room for it? I guess there has to be. I hope there is. It's very. But I don't know. I'm like finding my, I don't have any special knowledge. So I'm just finding my feet in it as well and trying to.
Well, I think that the internet provides room for everything. It's for like an ever expanding universe where.
Yeah, but who does it reach as well is very hard.
Well, it will reach the desired audience. Like, maybe. I'm sure that your podcast series is going to be a great success. And the traditional media are going to catch up to what's happening on the internet.
Sure. Yeah. Maybe. But I think there has to be, like, you have to have, this is just a general artist thing, though. Like, I think every artist, regardless of their culture or background, is just, like, you need to, you can't have to be creating for some other reason than, like, populism or, like, because there's nothing guaranteed,
you know? Yeah, I mean, exactly. The drive to create, the drive to tell stories is there, and it just can't rely on your unique selling point that you're a certain ethnicity. But it's been so fascinating to talk to you, and I'm really sad that I don't have more time this episode with you.
I'm just like, that was just like, that turned into like this kind of stoner philosophy. Like, what happened?
It did, didn't it? And neither of us is stoned.
I'm not a stoner, so.
Oh, well, neither am I.
Yeah, well.
We are just eating hummus and cookies and
carrots. What did you put in this hummus?
I just loved how random our conversation was today. Yeah. And I wouldn't change it. Like, I'm just not even going to edit it. I'm just going to put it all up.
Oh, my God.
As it is. People will get what they will out of it. And I really want to have you back on the podcast to talk about more stuff.
Yeah.
Thank you for your weird brain. Thank you for sharing it.
Thank you for asking me to chat. It was so nice.
I wish you all the best. Do you have anything, like any gigs coming up around Melbourne that you want to plug?
Well, it's kind of like December now. So I'm going home.
Don't plug now because this episode's going to come out later in February.
Sure. Well, I will have a comedy festival show at the Malt House. You can just follow my artist page on Facebook,
which is Vidya
Rajan. If you look that up,
got Sai in your name, right?
Yeah, but I'm gonna take it out. Like, I mean, it is part of my name, but I was like, I put it in there because I wanted my personal profile page to be different from my artist page.
Yeah.
But now I'm like, whatever, there is no boundaries. I have a website. I don't know. I'll give you some links or something.
Okay,
but
I'll put up the links. So please check out Vidya Rajan's Comedy Festival show in March 2020. Thank you, Vidya.
That's fine. Did you want to do your Frasier outro? What does Frasier say?
Until next time.
Yeah.
I'm listening. No, I don't know what
he says.
Frasier
Crane? Is that what he says?
This is so embarrassing. I should know because I watch hours of Frasier literally.
That's okay. All I remember is like Elvis has left the building.
Oh, the song you mean.
No, that's all I remember now.
Thank you, everybody. Good night, Seattle.
I love you.
I love you, Seattle.